Blog Talk Radio.
Hello everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Boy, last week we had a fabulous show, and I'd like to thank Fishman Public Relations CEO Brad Fishman for being my guest. Brad and I discussed how social media has really affected public relations. As always, all segments of Franchise Today are archived and are available on demand. So if you happen to miss last week's show, I highly recommend you access it at www.blogtalkradio.com/Franchise Today Show. Well, co-producer Joe Caruso has really outdid himself for today's show, which is entitled Social Media. It's not all fun and games, a legal perspective. Joe spends considerable time researching what potentially could be a hot topic. From LinkedIn groups to blogs, he looks for active discussions about franchising and events or situations tied to franchising. Of course, we know social media has been quite a buzz for quite some time now and continues to build momentum as more and more people embrace it. That momentum is also building within franchising, but, you know, we've grown accustomed to it. Franchising is not without legal concerns and implications, and social media certainly has the potential to compound the situation. So Joe found the perfect guest to address the legal implications of social media and its effect on franchising. As there are many naysayers that continue to stand firm on the position of social media policies not being necessary for franchise organizations, I'm really excited to discuss the same with Jonathan Redgrave, one of the leading authorities on information law. But before I introduce Jonathan, let's visit the IFA corner. As we know, Election Day is only 5 days away. So, to support its members, IFA has created online resources at franchisingvotes.com for civic-minded franchise members to participate in election activities. Now, IFA urges employees and guests to register to vote and turn out on Election Day. In a few days left leading to the election, IFA encourages its members to reach out to employees, fellow franchise leaders, friends, and family members to persuade them to vote as well. Contact the IFA Advocacy Director, Meredith Nethercutt, for more information. On the education front, IFA will conduct a round of regional seminars next month in Los Angeles that will address expansion, franchise sales and development, compliance, and emerging franchise strategies. First up are IFA's Franchise Development Super Session on November 3rd and 4th, Legal Roundtable, FranGuard, on November 4th, and Emerging Franchisor Roundtable Series on November 4th at the Millennium Biltmore. And right after these events, there's the IFA West Coast Franchise Expo, produced by MFV Expositions. The expo is November 5th to 7th, and it's at the Los Angeles Convention Center. And recently, the IFA announced the addition of new staff members to the Communication and Marketing Department to help support the priorities outlined in the IFA's new strategic plan, which are government relations, public relations, and professional development. Matthew Haller joins IFA today as Director of Communications. He will oversee IFA publications and help with IFA strategic communications. Most recently, Haller served as Director of Industry Relations and Development for the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, and previously he served as a Manager of Political Affairs at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Kristen White assumes the position of Director of Marketing to promote IFA programs, services, and managing the brand of all IFA materials. White was most recently the IFA Director of Graphic Design, and prior to joining IFA in June 2009, she held positions with Worldwide ERC, John Hancock Insurance and Financial Services, and Morton Fraser International. Rounding it out, Courtney Moore joins IFA as manager of graphic design and helped with the design and production of all IFA materials and publications, including online and digital communications. Now, if IFA Vice President of Marketing and Communications, Alyssa Harrison, was quoted as saying, "These three employees bring a wealth of experience to IFA as we continue to enhance how we present IFA and franchise information to members, policymakers, and, of course, the public. We're pleased to welcome each of them to the team to enhance how we communicate, including increasing the use of digital innovations in IFA activities." How appropriate in light of today's topic. Remember, the IFA convention is coming up faster than you think, and it'll be real easy to get sidetracked as we get further into the fourth quarter and as we get tied up with the upcoming holiday season. So don't hesitate any longer. Visit the Franchise Essentials site at www.fmdpro.com, and right at the top of the site is the IFA 2011 logo. Click on it, and you'll be directed right to the IFA convention page on the IFA website, and, of course, you can register right there. Now, today's guest, Jonathan Redgrave, serves as a trusted advisor to many Fortune 500 clients, providing strategic and ground-level advice and counsel. He also represents numerous clients involved in litigation and government investigation, has worked as an expert witness, and with special masters. Jonathan is internationally recognized for his work, has authored, co-authored, and edited numerous publications in the area of electronic discovery, privacy, and data security, has spoken around the world on these issues. Notably, Jonathan has extensive experience in all areas of complex litigation in state and federal court, and focuses his practice on information law matters. He regularly addresses issues involved in the discovery or electronically stored information, as well as issues concerning records, retention, and privacy policies and practices for clients. He has been recognized for exceptional standing in the legal community in Chambers USA, America's leading lawyers for business for 2010 for e-discovery. Jonathan, welcome to Franchise Today.
Thanks, Paul. Very glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you here, and it certainly is all the buzz within franchising, as I said. And I know today is going to be a very popular segment for Franchise Today. Now, your firm, Redgrave LLP, is focused on information law. Would you please share with our listeners the definition of information law?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Information law is kind of a broad umbrella that we use to describe the areas that we practice in, and it's areas where technology and the law kind of meet. And so things that you mentioned earlier, such as records retention, well, in today's day, you have all your information on computers, whether they're laptops, servers, maybe they're hosted in the cloud, but your information is there. And so managing that information requires an understanding of what the content is, as well as where the information is actually stored. We help companies work through the issues involved in managing that information. So the information law aspect there. Data protection and privacy, that also falls within this umbrella of information, because you're trying to apply rules that govern that content, where you can store it, how it's stored, where you keep it, who can access it. Again, information law. And then, of course, in the world of discovery, legal discovery, whether it's for an investigation, governmental investigation, or for a civil lawsuit, it's really a matter of, well, how do we get information? How do we preserve it? How do we collect it, review it, and produce it? Again, these are all things where you're dealing with technology and human process, but it's all dealing with information. So all those areas where the intersection of law and technology are, that's where we play, and that's where we advise companies, and whether it's behind the scenes or out front or out in court.
Absolutely fascinating. Not many would think that there was such a practice, but I'm sure it's definitely necessary. I mean, I know that. Well, you know, I know there are a lot of people within franchising anxious to learn more about, you know, the legal implications of social media and surrounding social media. So right off the bat, what cautionary words of advice would you give a franchisor contemplating the use of social media within its organization?
Well, you know, I will answer that a couple of ways, one of which is to refer back to the title of our session here. It's not all fun and games. I think a lot of people might listen to that title and say, oh, wow, it's going to be a negative. No, not really. When we're saying it's not all fun and games, we're talking about this being serious business. And by that, I want you to understand that from a legal perspective, I don't think lawyers should be the roadblocks laid down and say, oh, no, it's something new, it's something dangerous, stay away. Social media has a transformative effect on business. We are seeing this almost to a tipping point, using Malcolm Glazer's words, with respect to the way in which organizations can relate to your customers, relate to those people who are thinking about purchasing your products or your services. So the whole world of social media has an impact on business, especially franchise businesses, is potentially substantial. And so with that, it's serious business, and it's something that we should be looking at as a positive. How can this be leveraged well to extend the brand, to extend client satisfaction, customer loyalty, all sorts of things that are very positive for an organization. Now, it's also not all fun and games when we think that there are some restrictions that go along with this new world order of social media, and those we'll probably get into a little bit more depth here, but they run the gamut of how we explain ourselves as far as what the franchisor might be offering to a prospective franchisee, to how we actually relate to individuals, whether it's directly by our presence on a social media site or by having people that are associated going on to blogs or other places out in the world that kind of then you say something about the product or the service or the brand. And then there's a whole host of issues with respect to the employment relationships that might be within the context of a franchise world, where you might be picking up potential liability on the franchisor side, depending on the circumstance. There's a lot of opportunities here with respect to using social media platforms to collaborate with business partners and others. So there's another yet potential for opportunity, as well as, well, how do we actually regulate that? How do we keep information? How do we manage records of those transactions, for example? So once you start thinking about social media as a neutral, you say, okay, it's not just negative. We're not going to have lawyers run out and become roadblocks for it. How do we enable responsible use that's going to make sure we comply with the various rules, whether they be FTC mandates, whether they're rules we've always been associated with respect to what we can say or can't say about the franchise, or it's a whole new world about dealing with places and things people can say that they've never been able to do before. Just step back for a second and say, okay, we've got this new world. What we're going to talk about in the course of this hour is some practical ways we can take these pieces, pull them apart, talk about them, and have people start thinking for their situation, how do I deal with this so we're best enabled to work in this world? Because as you said, Paul, earlier, those folks that understand that this world of social media is really a groundbreaking opportunity to expand brands, to kind of build business, build client, customer loyalty, it's a fabulous thing. We shouldn't be thinking of it as a negative. So I want to make sure that's clear from the outset and really spend this hour talking about, okay, practically, what does this mean with respect to my interaction with the law?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. You know, at the beginning, as Joe and I started talking about the format and the topic for today's show, I thought, you know, I think we may need 2 hours, and that might be the case. We may need a follow-up with you. But, you know, of course, you know, within franchising, I mean, we all know the importance of trademark integrity, almost to the point of protecting trademark at all costs. But many within franchising that have embraced and even begun to embrace social media do not see reason for concern with respect to trademark and trade dress protection. I mean, should there be reason for concern?
In my view, there should be. The reality is, this is not just some email place or something where, you know, people can exchange just snippets of information. It is really a whole new branch of existence, so to speak, almost another dimension. It's not quite to the extreme for most of the Web 2.0 applications of Second Life, where you can actually have avatars and virtual presences, although there are some people that are there. But even when you're just talking about kind of a Facebook kind of presence or any of these other places where people can come, what you're seeing is that the individual going there or getting a brand experience. What do I mean by that? Well, there's certainly the marks that you'll see there that associate with what their brick and mortar kind of experience is, but the customer interaction, like when you have a live chat, someone comes up and they're going to chat because you've been on there and there's going to be a live interaction. Well, how does that person relate to me? Is it the same as I'm getting in the storefront location, or is it different? Is it going to be satisfactory or not satisfactory? You know what? The consumer, when they're on that site, they are associating the brand and the image and the name with the actual in-store experience. So they're kind of conflating these two, which isn't necessarily wrong. In fact, if you think about how do I build it, if they have a very positive experience out here in the internet, in that world, they're more likely to both interact with me online as well as interact in the store or wherever they're going to purchase the service or the merchandise or the product. So the idea of looking at this holistically is very important, but that also goes to the protection of very invaluable things such as the mark and trade dress. And now, usually when you think about trade dress, you talk about the signage, you talk about the look and feel of the stores, the layouts, and things like that. Why is the web that much different? Now, there are some obvious differences with respect to brick and mortar not being in existence, but we need to think about that web presence is something to consider protecting. It's also something that you really need to consider how you're able to interact with those that are within your franchise system that may have their own separate presence. And you start thinking to yourself, well, they're part of the system, but wait a second, they're really representing themselves very differently, or the consumer experience, the user experience is going to be very different the way they've set it up. Is that variation consistent with the way we want the brand to be imaged, brand to be positioned? And then depending on what they're doing, saying, or representing with respect to graphics and images and representations and things they could link or Flash Player that they have loaded with different videos or things like that, you can quickly see how there could be this confusion with respect to images or objects or other things that you don't want associated with a brand, so then becoming associated with a brand. Or clear trademark usage where there's an acceptable use and then you start seeing unacceptable uses. So there's a great potential for mischief out there. But to your bottom line question, should people be concerned? Well, I believe so, absolutely. Because if you don't, you run the risk of really, you know, set aside the legalities here. What's the practical aspect? You've really got the aspect of having confusion for your brand, confusion about what it means, what it says, what's the value, what's the quality, really who's behind it, and those things all undercut the value and what you're trying to do in the first place.
You know, as I stated at the top of the show, there are some within franchising, and I've seen this quite a bit in the LinkedIn discussion groups, that don't see the need for social media policies and procedures. I mean, some have actually compared social media as a communications tool, similar to the telephone, obviously, another communications tool. And their premise is, if you wouldn't develop policies to use the phone, why are policies needed for social media? Personally, I think that's a ridiculous comparison. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I suppose at some level I would agree that it's a ridiculous kind of argument. Now, I think what people are trying to say is that it's much different from that brick and mortar. Now, where in between does the truth lie? Well, I think it's going to be closer to the fact it's much more like the full experience. And the reason why is, take your example, the phone call. Well, we actually do, for certain organizations, have significant training with respect to how you're going to handle customers or clients who call in with either complaints or issues at either store or company-owned or franchise locations. There's a common script. There's a common way in which we want the customer to interact to experience the brand. So even on that two-dimensional level, so to speak, there are concerns that people have about managing that experience. Now, take it to the much broader three-dimensional world of social media, it's not just a one-to-one kind of communication like a phone. You've got multi-parties that are able to inject thoughts. You've got, depending on what platform you're on, the ability to inject graphics, images, links, all sorts of other sorts of media experiences that are much richer, much deeper and much more complex than a one-on-one telephone conversation. So it really needs to be something where people get out and fully understand what is this thing called social media, which if you've gone to any of the sites to see, you know, there's hundreds of different social media devices depending on what your reach is, what you're trying to do, what you're trying to push and publish or interact with people and having them be able to push and publish back. There's a lot of variants out there. There's a lot of opportunity out there. And so to just say it's kind of like a one-to-one phone call, I think misses the rich fabric that social media is becoming very quickly in our society. So I think that the view of we don't really need policies is a little bit naive because of so much opportunity. And then the reality is that maybe someone who would look at this as, I don't want to do that. We've got entire generations now that are growing up with this as their life in grade school and high school, and then they're moving into the workforce. This is where our workforce is going to go, and this is where our consumers are going. So to say that we're not going to be in that space and then say, how are we going to relate? How are we going to relate responsibly? Well, how do you do that? It's by having policies.
Right, and certainly, as you said, the way the workforce will be changing, you know, even today's consumer and franchise candidates alike, both have changed, being, of course, more sophisticated and educated, but also more technologically advanced than we've seen in the past. And then, of course, you add to it the economic woes that we've gone through and still continue to go through. To some extent, these candidates and consumers are also more cautious and anxious than ever before. And of course, because of the internet and accessibility of information, they're also more diligent. So, absolutely, I agree. But with respect to you know, social media, or let's just talk about, you know, franchisors' trademark and trade dress. What steps online should franchisors take to protect their marks and dress online?
Well, there's a couple things. A number of obviously services exist out there where you can monitor the usage. A number of people are very diligent about following up with those reports to see how people are using or misusing marks. So there's obviously the monitoring for misuse and unauthorized use. You've got within the systems and documentation actually setting forth guidelines or policies with respect to how people are going to use or not use marks and other aspects of trade dress within any sites that you might authorize or allow to be used that would be relating to the franchise. So it's really a matter of stepping back into the documentation to see what you've actually outlined, if you haven't, going and putting provisions in place with respect to monitoring and seeing what people are doing, being vigilant, going out there and being ready to enforce if you think someone is infringing, doing something inappropriate, misusing that could injure your rights with respect to the image, with respect to the marks. So it's really having a plan where you've thought through, you've looked at this as a space where those issues can arise, and you just have a plan to deal with it from a perspective basis, working with any person to have responsibility to post that might have the ability to post or to create sites or to interact in a way that could impact the brand, that you've got guidance. So it's being done in a way that you think is consistent with the brand and the marks. And then with respect to infringement, that you are diligent and vigilant.
Absolutely. You know, at Franchise Essentials, we always talk about social media eIdea, which is our very simple acronym for explore, identify, develop, execute, and analyze. And it's something we tell all our clients. They have to go through this process before they even get involved in social media. And certainly as they're exploring social media, they need to answer those questions, you know, ahead of time, and how it's going to be monitored, how it's going to be policed, how are we going to react in case of a crisis, and so forth. You know, there are many naive social media proponents that wrongly believe that a constructive social media policy will stifle creativity and engagement. And I think they need to just, you know, look at it very objectively, because it's no different than any other type of marketing, any other type of advertising or promotion, and don't just be a naysayer and push it aside and say we don't need to have a policy, because I know, Jonathan, you probably agree, you know, and a lot of franchisors, you know, look at trademark and trade dress, and they're very bricks and mortar oriented. They look at the signage, and they're very precise and concise in how a franchisor is or how a franchisee is allowed to use that signage. And, you know, the same type of policies and procedures and guidelines, if you will, need to be in any way, shape, fashion, or form that a franchisee uses the brand name or any similarity to the brand message and brand recognition that's out there, without a doubt. You know, what about the case where franchisees got there first? I mean, they're online. They've established Facebook pages, they've established Twitter accounts, and a host and plethora of other social media. What's your recommendation to the franchisors in those cases?
Well, obviously you're not necessarily in the best world possible, but you are where you are. And I think what's important is to not try and be dictatorial unless there's some grave harm being done to the brand through that presence. And maybe, like we've done, brands have done, is you look to some of the more creative franchises out there, people that come up with different product developments, line extensions, and you think about how they're using social media as maybe somewhat of an experiment base, and you try to bring them within your umbrella of where you want to go. I thought back when you were just mentioning kind of the whole idea about how to prospectively think about getting into social media. It's not something you just jump into. Again, it's not child's play. But this whole area, kind of give you a useless factoid. In 1907, John Peyton Powell helped found the scouting movement. And I'm very familiar with it because I have six boys. The oldest is an Eagle Scout, and very proud of them. And the scouting program is really good, and it really goes back to that motto that so many people, even if you've never been involved in scouts, knows, and it's called be prepared. You know, and it's the whole thing about social media. If you're going to be out there, it's being prepared. So what does that mean with respect to the franchisee who may have gotten out in front of you? Well, okay, we find ourselves in a situation in the woods we weren't prepared for necessarily. Well, let's get prepared. That means reaching out to them, finding out what they're doing, coming back internally saying, okay, we need to have a plan for the future, and we're going to have to figure out how this these people that have been out there ahead of us, how do we bring them into the fold? And, you know, it might come up with some hard decisions. You might find out that the way in which someone has put something together, the way they've been interacting locally, it might be good for them, but it's not good for the brand. It might not be good for the entire experience you want someone to have with respect to the look, the feel, the interaction. There could be a whole host of issues. But if you do it properly, more often than not, you're going to be able to figure out a way to bring them in and help them be a champion, quite frankly, within the system. But if you just come down with dictatorial rules, and again, this is just being very practical here. This is not quite as much you legally need to do this, but it's real practical. That if you're dictatorial, you're gonna tick people off, you're going to make them adversarial to you. But if you can actually convert them to sort of be champions and help lead you and the rest of the system within the context of social media and finding a good place, it could be very, very positive. So I'd encourage people to understand, first of all, what everyone's doing in the system. If you haven't been active yourself, but there are some that are out there, survey. Figure out what everyone's doing. Take a look at them. Figure out what the best practices are or what might be the kind of the best use of the media to enhance the brand experience. And then start figuring out ways to create a team that's going to be your kind of a SWAT team to look at the opportunities, kind of collect the information, and then develop a plan by which you're going to actually launch a more global approach to this. And, you know, the global approach might be a little bit of top-down and a lot from bottom-up. And the bottom-up can be guidelines to other franchisees who are independent to say, here's their ground rules about what we'd like you to create. Or it might be completely top-down driven, saying, we're just going to provide the tools and the platform and everything else for you, and you know, here's a way in which we want you to interact in that system. You know, there's not necessarily a one-size-fits-all answer here, but what everyone should be thinking about is be prepared. And, you know, if you're not prepared yet and people are out in front of you, you know what? You can always start tomorrow, so let's do it. Let's start getting prepared tomorrow and having a plan for this area, because it's not child's play.
Absolutely. I mean, very good point. Be prepared. And certainly a convince rather than demand mentality would go a long way. And we talk a lot about, the internet, it's online, it's basically electronic. There's an E in front of everything that's electronic, whether it be e-books. Franchise Essentials has the big E between Franchise and Essentials. And we've heard that phrase repeatedly. And I know this may be a complicated, multi-part question, but, you know, so here goes. You know, what are electronic records? What are the requirements for saving them? And in the matter of a legal dispute, what are the requirements for producing them?
Wow, that is a big question with many, many parts. It's almost like a hydra or any of the things in Greek mythology where you cut off one head and two grow. But let's break it down into its essentials. Pretty much in the legal world, and Discover kind of come up with this term called electronically stored information. And many people joke about the legal disclaimers you'll hear on advertisements, because it's usually some actor that speaks at 200,000 words per minute babbling off a bunch of terms, which just lets you know that lawyers can come up with synonyms like there is no tomorrow. But basically, pretty much any piece of information that's stored, even for a nanosecond, can be considered electronically stored information. And that's practically everything we deal with. So all your Word documents, all your unstructured data, your emails, databases, you name it, it's in the computer, it's going to be electronically stored information. Now, not all information that we generate is going to rise to the level of what is a record. Now, with respect to records, obviously in the franchise context, there are certain FTC mandated records retention requirements. You also have other government agencies that mandate certain retention, whether it's OSHA, might be EPA. There's all sorts of different agencies that will issue guidelines that will influence what ultimately becomes known as the records retention schedule, which is your listing of your various categories, types of documents, and against that, what the legal requirements are for how long you must be able to keep certain information that becomes designated as a record. So these things that are identified, they become records. Now, a record could be in an email format if someone so chooses to keep it in that format, or that's the way it is. It could be a written document that's in paper. It could be an electronic Word-type document. It could be entries in a database. There's practically limitless variations of what could be a record, but there's this idea of what's a record is smaller than the universe of information, because there's a lot of just chatter back and forth, things like that, that might be work in progress that ultimately become the things that are records. Now, so that's the records management world. You focus on things that rise to the level of importance. They're going to be a record. They're going to be managed against a schedule. And then at the end of their scheduled time period for being kept, they're going to be deleted or destroyed in some sort of systematic process. And by the way, getting rid of things in a systematic way when there's no other duty to preserve them, and we'll get to that in a second for lawsuits, that's acceptable. The United States Supreme Court in the Arthur Anderson decision a number of years ago clearly stated that the routine destruction of information in the ordinary course, even to keep it out of the hands of the government, was a valid thing, provided that there was a process for exceptional cases. Now, what do we mean by exceptional cases? That's when there really is a lawsuit or reasonable anticipation of litigation or some investigation that triggers what is known as the duty to preserve. The duty to preserve basically tells you need to save information, which is that larger bucket, any information that might be relevant to the subject matter of the dispute or the investigation. So it could be potentially broad. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to save the ends of the earth, but it certainly can go beyond what is known as a record. So it might be for certain custodians or people, all of their emails might have to be preserved, or all of their emails on a subject, whether or not they were, quote-unquote, a record. So it's a broader concept, and it certainly reaches to everything electronic. The definition of electronically stored information I mentioned earlier, that was actually enshrined in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure in the 2006 amendments, 2005. And what happened thereafter has been the development of law, just kind of confirming how broad that is. And quite frankly, even before then, we had case law that was getting to a very, very broad definition of what was a document to include all electronic type of information. So at the end of the day, pretty much everything's in play. You've got records. Needs to be a more thoughtful discernment, distillation process that you get down to things that we need to keep. We also have, by the way, for those record schedules, not only the legal time periods, we might have business reasons why we want to keep information for certain time periods. It allows us to mine the data, to think about, you know, we were going to have these transactions we're going to keep things for. And also, some of the records you're going to keep for a very long time, whether they're employment records or real estate records. So there's all sorts of different types of records that will come up, each having their own guidance, whether it's business-driven or legal-driven with respect to some statute or regulation, or even a statute of limitations could tell you that you need to keep certain documents about certain transactions or information because of potential that someone could file a lawsuit on something. So those all guide the whole area of records and information management and the development of record schedules. On the legal hold thing, or I should say on the legal preservation, there's this thing called a legal hold that I'm sure a lot of people have heard about. And that is no more than having a procedure or a process by which you understand there's a duty to preserve. What are you going to do to make sure the organization meets that? And you just go through your process of what we call implementing a legal hold. That's sending notices to certain custodians. It's collecting information from certain custodians or data systems. Just making sure that the evidence that a court might say needed to be preserved actually is, so you don't get in trouble. Because the downside of this, if you don't do this well, can really leave you in a world of hurt with respect to sanctions and bad things. That's a really good legal term for you, bad things. But overall, that's kind of, Paul, to answer your question with respect to information and records. Records is that subset. Information is the bigger circle. And electronic, practically everything is there and everything's in the game.
Absolutely. I mean, franchisors and franchisees are in the social media and election world, like it or not. And they need to accept this reality. And, you know, certainly putting one's head in the sand is not an option. And I could just imagine the franchisor that happens to be in a lawsuit get hit with interrogatories and production of documents and feel like, okay, you know, they're asking for all my electronic records. You know, hey, go about, you know, erase that. And I mean, no, they can't undo bad electronic social activity. In fact, you know, the cover-up is likely worse than the error or the bad behavior. But, you know, give a word to advice to the franchisors that may contemplate such a foolish decision, because I know just pressing delete does not really delete it. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Just pressing delete doesn't mean that it's necessarily gone. At the same token, I've been a member of the Sedona Conference, which is a 501c3 organization with a working group in this area of document retention and production that's really focused on making sure that the rules that are applied by courts are reasonable. So just because someone's deleted something doesn't necessarily mean that it was something that you necessarily had. But the reality is, if you're trying to delete stuff to keep them out of a lawsuit in particular, that can get to obstruction of justice. That can get to criminal charges. So this is very serious stuff. And certainly when you have intentional spoliation, and that's meaning the destruction of information, you can have sanctions against an organization that run the gamut of monetary sanctions, preclusion of evidence, meaning you can't bring people in to testify or put documents in. It could be an adverse inference jury instruction, which means the jury is instructed to infer that what was missing was adverse to you, and I'll tell you, juries can imagine things far worse than your worst employee can write, or they can enter a default judgment. Basically, you lose because you weren't able to produce information because you intentionally destroyed it. So this is very serious stuff, and there's no circumstance where someone should, when they have a lawsuit that's been filed, they're anticipating it, go around and start deleting information. Now, it's a much different world when we say, well, how should we manage information in this space? And this gets to some very tricky issues when you start talking about Web 2.0 and social media, because your typical duties run to information that you're in your possession, custody, or control. If you've got information that you're kind of participating in a group blog or someone else's website, but it's not your page, you don't have ownership and things like that over it, there's a good question that maybe you don't really have any ability to go and preserve or do other things to it. It might be a third party that's hosting it that might be the person someone needs to contact. But with respect to sites or pages or places that you have possession, custody, or control over, there's going to be a greater expectation that you have been managing that well. Now, if you don't have litigation out there, what does that mean? Are these things you're putting out there records? It's an interesting question because for, you know, a number of organizations for years, they treated press releases, anything that's to the public, with a certain kind of level of rigor in as a record, and they kept it for a certain amount of time. Not as much thought has been given to social media, even though in many ways what you're saying is the same sort of kind of presentation to the world that someone may use against you or try to use against you, or they may try and twist it and make it something else and say you said it when you didn't. So there's all sorts of interesting complications that have come up in the world of Web 2.0 and even Web 1.0 about how much of what you're putting out there publicly do you need to capture to be able to recreate down the road to prove that what you did was reasonable, that what someone's putting in front of you wasn't what you published, that what you published had a context that made it appropriate as opposed to a snippet that someone is using. So there's a lot of complications here with respect to both the records management side, but then on the evidence preservation side, where do my duties run? What do I need to preserve? And for those areas where I do have this magic possession, custody, or control, what is my plan? How would I go about preserving that information? And with this, you know, there's probably no magic answer. I know of several vendors that are looking at ways in which to preserve. Some people tout that they've got this magic preservation elixir that, you know, you pour on your computer and it'll preserve everything about a social media site or a website. Well, the reality is, especially for even the moderately robust sites, you've got so much dynamic content, Flash, other things out there. It's really hard to say, show me what your web page or what this site or this presence looked like on March 1st, 2007. Very difficult. But there are ways in which you can capture parts of it. There are ways in which you can recreate parts of it. And the idea here is, what is your plan? Go back to Baden-Powell, 1907, with the Boy Scout concept. Be prepared. What would our plan be for this? How are we going to respond? And you know what? It may be we don't have that much, or we haven't saved that much, and here's our reason why. It's a lot better to be able to stand up in court and say, this is our plan. This is what we're doing. This is what we're not doing, than to stand up and say, Judge, I don't know, or Judge, we never thought of it. Those last two answers don't get you very far, and they certainly don't enhance your credibility with the court. But if you can stand up and explain what you've done, even if it is nowhere close to perfect, you've got a good start. In this area here, I think there's a lot of grace given still in the social media space with respect to there being, you know, a lot of uncertainties with respect to exactly how would you do it from a corporate perspective, try and find and capture everything. Now, I will add one little snippet of warning for people. I was looking at a case this morning. It's September 9th from a state court in Pennsylvania, and it was really a case dealing with a race car driver, in fact. But the bottom line was, could the defendant get into the plaintiff's social media sites that the plaintiff was saying, well, this is my private space. You know, I'm sure I have some friends, but I've all, you know, demarked it as private, and in fact, moved some stuff from public to private. But basically, the court came out and said, you know, there's nothing private about the internet, you know, or about social media sites. When you look at the terms of use, even though you're designating things there for only certain people to see it, the idea was that other people would see it. And the bottom line was the court ordered that plaintiff to turn over all of their passwords and all of their information with respect to their social media use. Well, okay, that's not a franchise context. That's an individual. But what's important here for our discussion is that viewpoint of this state court judge in Pennsylvania saying, look, that social media experience, that social media site, if it's relevant, they get it. They will get it. Go and give them the keys and the access. So what would that mean for your question you actually asked me. Well, if you're out there deleting stuff and moving stuff from social media because you're fearful that you've done something wrong, if you're doing that specifically to get things out of the eye of a public lawsuit that's already been filed or that's reasonably anticipated and you delete it, that could be a problem. Now, you could see a situation where you've got something out there, you say, we don't want it out there because we do think it's problematic. You could take it down as long as you preserve it. So you could say, this is what we had up last year, and you produce that in a litigation. They say, why did you take it down? You get into a doctrine or subsequent remedial measures, perhaps, or something else like that. But quite frankly, sometimes you say, we changed it because what we have on the website today is better. We believe it's more accurate, or whatever it is, you can explain the change. But what you've noticed in what I did there is because I thought there was litigation or I knew there was litigation around, I did not destroy it. I might have taken it down from that web presence, but I didn't destroy it or delete it. That's where things get into huge problems if, in the course of making things better, even though I know there's a legal duty to preserve that's been triggered, I start deleting stuff. That's bad news.
You know, Ed, in all of these discussions that we have on Franchise Today, as we talk about best practices and we talk with a lot of the best minds in franchising and in related aspects of franchising, we always seem to be coming back to practical common sense. Daryl Johnson mentioned it a while back from Frandetta when we were talking about franchise financing. Ronald Feldman mentioned the same thing. Lane Fisher's mentioned the same thing. Brett Fishman last week mentioned the same thing, and I hear it again today, and it just resonates again and again. Practical common sense. I just think that's something that we really need to look at as an industry. And, you know, I know social media has amplified the concern of franchisors and their attorneys alike with vicarious liability, whether it be what the franchisees are doing or even what their franchise brokers are doing. And as we know, franchising has specific disclosure laws that pertain to selling franchises. And we know that many franchisors are working with independent franchise brokers. So, you know, what responsibility does a franchisor have for messages by franchise brokers on social media? I mean, you know, as it relates to vicarious liability and of course, you know, guidance and, of course, control and how that all fits into the equation.
Yeah, there's a host of issues in that one, too. Another one of our Greek mythological creatures coming at us. I think what people need to understand is that in some ways, the law doesn't change. So if you have an agent who's acting on your behalf to do some action on your behalf, there can be vicarious liability for that action, whether that action is taken at Joe's coffee shop, is taken at the mall, is taken in an office room, or is taken on the internet. So we need to understand that some of the concepts for vicarious liability can happen regardless of the format. It's a matter of, was there an agency relationship? Was there a action within the scope of the agency relationship? And then what followed from that action or inaction or misrepresentation, what have you? So with respect to the actions of an agent of the franchisor, I think there has to be significant concern and guidance given. Because you cannot just assume that, once it's out of your sight, it's out of your mind or out of your, basically, responsibility. So there, I believe, should be significant concerns if you have agents, whether it's a broker or anyone else, that is then making statements or representations about your finances or your prospects or other things that are completely different, inconsistent with the financial disclosure or the franchise disclosure documentation. You should be very concerned. You should ensure that there is consistency rather than just creating a risk of inconsistency that can lead to significant problems. One of the issues that's raised with respect to vicarious liability kind of reminds me somewhat different, but the reality of, well, how much control? I mean, you guys are talking about social media and you've talked about policies here. Well, how much control do I need to put out there with respect to the franchisee use of social media and how they're going to be saying and doing things? And one of the problems here is that if you exercise too much control over what the franchise is doing, are you going to be liable for every single thing they say or do out in the world? I have seen contexts where franchisors have been held liable for the local franchisee acts on employment law matters because of the elements of control that were existing in the franchise agreements. So can that happen? Well, sure, anything's possible. It depends on how stringent and how much control you had over what people were supposed to do in the social media space. And then if you're going to have a high degree of control, what are you going to do to police it? Now, what kind of mischief are we talking about that you can get into? Well, just remember, you might have privacy issues if you had someone that's disclosing information about an employee that they shouldn't, or about customers that they were using without consent. You could have information with respect to employment disputes. You could have disclosure of corporate information with respect to the system, how it operates, other information that you want competitors or others to know. You could have disclosure of trade secrets with respect to the product or the service. You could have that franchisee in the space infringing intellectual property of others. You could have defamation. I mean, there's all sorts of things here that that could happen with anyone, whether it's your employee or you. You could run into all those problems. But to the extent that you are now going to be the police or have, you know, policies or guidance out there, one of the questions you need to ask yourself is, are we getting into a situation where we're trying to exert too much control such that, quite frankly, we are going to be liable for everything that they do in this space, and do we want to pick up that much control where we pick up that much liability? And it's really a measure of judgment and then a measure of managing your risk, understanding where that risk lies. So this is not, again, it's not child's play. It's something to be thought through carefully with respect to how you're going to put guidance documents in place. And so we've kind of morphed here in my answer from your original question with respect to brokers, but you're getting into that situation with, what is my relationship with others? How are these others going to use this world that we're calling social media or Web 2.0? How is that going to impact me? How does it impact my relationship with others within the system or outside the system that are the consumers, the clients, the customers, or even the government agencies that might be interested in what we're doing? So there's this holistic vision of how you fit and interact with these other players. How is it that you are going to provide guidance for them so that they protect you and they don't harm you? And then how is it that you're going to have adequate controls to make sure that what they do don't adversely impact you, but you haven't, in the process of doing that, picked up more liability than you bargained for by essentially having control over everyone so that the independence that you had for certain people is completely blown away. So, again, it's not child's play. These are issues you need to think through. It is very fact-specific to your circumstance, what your agreements are, what your relationships are, how your system is set up and how it operates, but certainly something that you should be thinking about with respect to your holistic social media strategy and your governance plan.
You know, I could just see franchise professionals sitting at their desk right now listening to this with their head in their hands, shaking their head, saying, you know, oh, my God. Or if they are social media savvy, they may be saying, OMG.
Yeah.
What, you know, so let's hit them with reality here.
Don't panic, because, people. I mean, you want a reality point here. You're hearing these things. We're highlighting issues. But you know what? If people were really scared of the woods and they're scared of snakes and you're scared of not being able to tie the right ropes to hang a bear bag, no one would ever go out in the woods. You'd never go camping. Well, that was, again, back to my scout story I had in the middle of the show here, one of the things about being prepared was it was a dangerous world out there. You didn't want to take a bunch of 12 and 14 and 16-year-olds out to the mountains of New Mexico or out to the boundary waters to go canoeing for a week in northern Minnesota or into Canada without being prepared. But you know what? If you're prepared, you can succeed. If you're prepared with respect to social media, and that's all we're really telling everyone today in today's show, that these are issues you need to think about seriously. It's not child's play. But it doesn't mean that you're not going to be able to use it. It doesn't mean that you should stay away from it. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't even have some fun along the way, because these are really creative places where you can do things to really enhance the brand experience. You can really enhance the consumer or the client's or the customer's relationship with you. You can deepen it. You can broaden it. They can suddenly become advocates for you, champions for you in ways that never would have happened in our old world before the social media explosion. So these are all very positive opportunities, and we want to make sure that you understand that, but you then get down to the practical let's make sure we have a plan, that we understand where we are and where we want to be, and that we're prepared.
Yeah, I think a good word of advice is, as casual as social media seems to be, obviously within business and franchising, it's not casual at all. It is serious. But, you know, it's no different than traditional media. And, of course, we can have social media creativity just like we have it in the traditional sense. What other legal issues can you share with us about electronic documents, legal discovery, privacy, and their effect on business?
Well, a couple of things real quick is that while we talk a lot in this country about Facebook or MySpace or LinkedIn as places people go see and are seen, the rest of the world has other social media engine sites and places where people go to exchange information, to say things. So if you're having if you're involved with a global franchise, you need to understand there's going to be different customs and practices and certainly different technologies and sites. So your policies and your guidance have to be somewhat agnostic with respect to the particular social media application. And you should really do that anyway, because we all know how things can change very fast. You might have 500 million friends on Facebook today, but 5 years from now, if there was some issue or some event or some value proposition someone adds, all 500 million friends could transmute to something else. And just like any of the other tools we have, there's a lot of development still out there with respect to different interactive places. So my guidance there would be, make sure you're looking at this with a view of some sort of agnosticism with respect to the particular types of sites. I mean, you should reflect where you are and what you're doing, but think about a policy and a guidance that's kind of broader than any one particular channel at this particular time. Secondly, understand that there are very different regimes with respect to privacy expectations in different countries. For example, in Europe, privacy is viewed as a fundamental human right. That is very different from the way in which we view privacy in the United States, kind of a click-on, click-off kind of toggle view somewhat that people can just consent or very lightly consent and then is gone. There are significant movements here in the United States for different states that are thinking about legislation. There's some federal legislation pending that might strengthen, but clearly right now today is a much different story, data protection, data privacy overseas. So those kind of things can dramatically impact the kind of information that you're capturing and what you're doing with it. Don't go into that lightly, because there can be significant penalties overseas under those regimes. So those are two things I wanted to make sure I get out on the table. Other than that, think holistically not only about your social media policies, but then how do they relate to how we're going to do records information management, what do we need to keep, or even the electronic discovery, the discovery aspect, what are we going to preserve, how would we preserve it, where would we preserve it, who would pull it out, what would it look like, and remember, don't let perfection be the enemy of the good. If you try to do a system that's going to capture everything, it's going to be perfect, you're going to be waiting until the year 2500, because there is no perfection. And the good news is, I want to make sure I leave people with good news, is that courts understand that neither records management nor discovery is this perfect world. What they're looking for is reasonableness, good faith, due diligence, some pretty basic parameters there that then people should be thinking about, well, how is my system repeatable? How is it defensible in terms of how we're governing the space, how we're having an information governance plan, and then how do we execute against that plan for both records management and then legal discovery? So those are all practical things that people should think about as a framework to put over their particular situation, but make sure you look in the social media space to where you want to be and how you want to be seen and perceived, and what you want the interaction to be with your brand, and that's kind of paramount, and then go from there.
Well, you've given us a tremendous amount of things to think about and a lot of great information. I know I certainly appreciate it, as I am very entrenched in the social media aspect of business. And I know I've received a couple of emails now and an instant message from Joe Caruso that said it's obvious we'll need to invite you back soon and often. And I definitely concur. And, you know, Jonathan, we're quickly approaching the top of the hour. I knew we would blow through this, and I knew that's probably going to leave a lot of questions unanswered. So I would like to invite you back into the future and extend that same request and offer from Joe Caruso. The information you shared was quite enlightening, and I can't thank you enough for being my guest on Franchise Today.
Very, very, very happy to be here. I'd be happy to come back at any time and dig into any of this. It's fun stuff for me, and I hopefully people realize that even though we said it's not all fun and games, there can be a little bit of fun here, and it's just a matter of taking it seriously as a real business proposition and something to be managed.
For our listeners' benefit, give them the URL for your firm's website, please.
Sure. www.redgravellp.com.
Well, that's great. I appreciate it again. And today's show will be available later today on demand at www.blogtalkradio.com/franchise today show. Thanks again to my co-producer, Joe Caruso, for helping to make Franchise Today very popular within the franchise community. Your efforts are greatly appreciated. So until next week, I'm Paul Segretto, wishing you the best of luck in this great thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is out.